Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
A South Florida ecological disaster could wind up spurring more environmental protections.
The unfolding tragedy in Lake Okeechobee in the estuaries, where so much water is being discharged to the coast, that people are up in arms and demanding that something be done.
Also tonight, compromise restrictions are in the works for a controversial law enforcement policy. Officials say it's important not to remove the process completely.
In our view, any time that you're using drug dealer money instead of taxpayer money is a good thing.
We'll also hear an impassioned debate about public assistance and pay respects to a legendary Florida jurist. I'm Tom Flanagan. We end the next to final week of the 2016 Florida lawmaking session, and this is Capital Report. Seasonal flooding continues to threaten Lake Okeechobee's Herbert Hoover Dike, and the pressure is being felt as far north as Tallahassee. Lawmakers there have agreed on an environmental spending plan that addresses massive releases of brown water from the polluted lake, and Jim Ash has the story.
House and Senate negotiators shook hands late last week on a sliver of the $80 billion budget that goes to the environment. Veteran Audubon of Florida lobbyist Eric Draper gives the deal mixed reviews.
It looks like Everglades did really well. That is in part due to the unfolding tragedy in Lake Okeechobee in the estuaries, where so much water is being discharged to the coast that people are up in arms and demanding that something be done.
Governor Rick Scott recently put Lee, Martin, and St. Lucie counties under a state of emergency after federal regulators sent billions of gallons of Lake Okeechobee cascading into the Caloosahatchee and St. Lucie rivers. The result is algae blooms that kill fish and chase away tourists. The budget includes $51 million for plumbing and reservoirs that can store and filter the water before it does harm. The deal includes $100 million for Everglades restoration and about $90 million to buy parks and wildlife through the land buying program called Florida Forever. But it does not include authorization to borrow money for land conservation, a priority of the Trust for Public Lands, Will Aberger.
Bonding for land acquisition has always made sense in Florida. Land values in Florida are not going down, and interest rates are at historic lows, so it makes sense to acquire the land now while it's cheaper and we need the money up front.
Republican Senator Thad Altman of Rockledge joined forces recently with Democratic Senator Darren Soto of Kissimmee to propose a bonding amendment, but it failed. Florida was spending $350 million a year on Florida Forever in more flush times. This year, lawmakers proposed to spend about $35 million on a program called Rural and Family Lands. It buys conservation easements from farmers and ranchers who agree not to develop. Nature Conservancy lobbyist Janet Bowman says there are advantages and disadvantages to the approach.
There are times that full fee has its place, certainly when you've got a lot of public access or very sensitive resources.
But she says easements are tempting for cost-conscious lawmakers. For example, local governments continue to collect property taxes.
So you've got a landowner that is continuing to manage the land, and that's extremely important.
Some environmentalists considered conservation easements a sweetheart deal to landowners when it was first proposed. But Audubon of Florida's Charles Lee says the controversy has faded.
The only controversy I see about conservation easements right now is that we can't get enough of them. And, we've literally got millions of acres in the headwaters of the Everglades, which could be protected through easements if there is enough revenue to do those easements.
The legislature has also agreed, at the urging of Republican Senator Charlie Dean of Inverness, to spend $50 million on springs restoration. Some of that money would also buy land to reduce development pressure. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
The Florida Senate took up and unanimously approved changes to the state civil forfeiture provisions today. Nick Evans reports the proposal raises the threshold for law enforcement agencies to seize someone's assets.
For St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis, the problems with civil asset forfeiture
are pretty obvious.
Under current law, government could seize assets without actually making an arrest of a person. And I think people are just generally shocked by that fact, that how can the government take something from a Floridian, from a citizen, without charging them with a crime?
The war on drugs provides the pretext for many asset seizures, but the legal justifications require a bit of fancy footwork. Rather than arresting a person, the law enforcement agency arrests the person's property. This gives the agency two advantages. First, it undermines the criminal activity by taking away the proceeds of breaking the law, things like money, jewelry, and cars. Second, because the seized asset is property, the case plays out in civil court, where there's no guarantee of counsel.
This is a tool that was designed to go after drug lords. And what happens when the airplane that comes with cocaine full of cocaine lands in some deserted swamp, right?
But the provisions have come under fire in recent years because they've been used for much smaller seizures. And it's not always clear how much agencies are bringing in or where the funds are going.
One of the things that the OPAGA report, or our Office of Analytics for the legislature, determined was that there was no transparency. Most of the law enforcement agencies that they reviewed didn't know where the money was going, couldn't clearly show how it was spent. There was no standardization. Some were not even sure who had to sign off on final forfeiture actions. And so it was really a glaring error in just keeping the books on civil forfeiture.
This is the second year Brandis is working on changes, and he's been pushing a simple formula. No seizure without an arrest, and no forfeiture without a criminal conviction. Law enforcement officials say this would gut an important tool, and they've pushed back on criticisms. But now it appears they've found some common ground.
You know, there's an adage, you don't have to be sick to get better. And we want to make sure that...
Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri chairs the Florida Sheriff's Association's Legislative Committee. Under the compromise they've brokered, seizures will, for the most part, require an arrest. But rather than requiring a criminal conviction to take ownership of seized property, the case will stay in civil court, and the agency will have to meet a higher burden of proof.
And so under the new law, it raises the bar just up a little bit more. And as opposed to proving by clear and convincing evidence, we have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this is proceeds of crime or something used in committing crime. So I don't think it's any big deal, and I think that as long as we do what we're supposed to do and make good cases, we can meet that burden, and there's no issue.
Brandis's measure increases the amount of forfeiture funds earmarked for charity from 15 to 25%. It also incorporates transparency provisions from a measure offered by Fernandina Beach Republican Senator Aaron Bean. Those portions require written procedures, annual reporting, and the approval of the agency head before a forfeiture case begins. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Still to come on Capitol Report, one lawmaker says reporting injuries could save greyhounds' lives.
They start fixing the dog's broken leg because they don't want you to know that they're euthanizing dogs that just have broken legs.
The proper role and scope of government becomes the bottom line in a legislative debate on public assistance.
That would be, I think, the organizing principle of the bill, is to not establish a circumstance where illegal immigration leads to the drawdown of tax dollars from hardworking Floridians.
And we'll remember an historic and much-loved Florida Supreme Court jurist.
As a justice, I appeared before him, so I know he listened well, was deliberate, did not rush to judgment, and wrote opinions that the lawyers and the litigants could understand.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.
Florida lawmakers seem willing to give some terminally ill Floridians access to medical marijuana, but as Lynn Hatter reports, medical marijuana expansion supporters are already setting their sights on November.
Florida's medical marijuana system is small, and by a lot of accounts, it's deeply flawed and broken. Republican Senator Jeff Brandis railed about a program that 2 years after its passage still hasn't provided qualified children the non-euphoric strain of medical marijuana as promised. Instead, the program has been mired in lawsuits between the state and businesses wanting to cultivate the plant. Now, Florida lawmakers are trying to expand the state's fledgling marijuana industry by adding more terminal patients to the list of those that qualify for medical marijuana. But lawmakers like Democratic Senator Jeff Clemons argues that list isn't long enough, and more than 30 amendments seeking to expand the list of conditions that qualify, and some that relate to who can grow marijuana, failed.
There are alternatives to doing what we've done that work, and they've been proven to work in 20-something states across the United States. And we here in Florida, at the behest of the House, decided to do something different.
Republican Senator Rob Bradley swatted them off. He says the bill is a compromise brokered with the House, one that could be put in jeopardy should amendments be added after the fact.
This bill will make sure that we finally deliver on the promise that we made in 2014. And that probably is the most important thing the bill does.
But Republican Senator Jack Latvala, among other lawmakers, don't buy that argument. And throughout the debate on the so-called Right to Try Act, there was a common theme. If this is bad, then wait until voters have their say on a far broader constitutional amendment to bring medical marijuana to the state. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
While there appears to be no way forward for gambling legislation that would ratify a gaming agreement between the state and Seminole Indian Tribe, lawmakers in the Florida House are finding new paths for their gaming priorities. Regan McCarthy has more.
The House put what seems to be the final nail in the gaming overhaul coffin when it failed to take the bill up Friday. House Speaker Steve Crisafulli used the old refrain, never say never, while speaking with reporters after the House session, but he doesn't hold out much hope.
We've done what we can do in the House by bringing the bill forward. We brought it out of committee, brought it to the floor, waited till the very last moment to see if there was a deal struck, and there wasn't. And so, you know, without a willing partner to pass that piece of legislation, it was not going to get done. And we are where we are. And, we'll see what happens with regard to the courts at this point.
Meanwhile, some lawmakers are looking for new avenues for their gaming priorities. And one such path appears to be a measure filed by Tampa Republican Representative James Grant.
Representative Grant, you're recognized to explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Members, this is the deregulation package of 2016. That is the bill, Mr. Speaker.
Grant's bill eases up on regulations for a number of professions like yacht and ship brokers. But Coral Springs Democratic Representative Jared Moskowitz hoped he could use the measure to increase regulations for greyhound racers. He filed an amendment that would require reporting greyhound injuries. He says right now there's a loophole.
There is a loophole in the injury reporting law. Here is the loophole. If a greyhound dies on the track, they have to report it. But if the greyhound is dying or his injuries are not severe enough that it will die at the track and they euthanize it somewhere else, or the greyhound dies somewhere else, it dies in the vehicle on the way to the vet, they don't have to tell us.
Moskowitz says about 300 greyhound deaths are generally reported by tracks each year, but he says many more greyhounds die. And he says similar legislation has had a major impact in other states where it's been implemented.
In states that have instituted this sort of injury reporting, guess what has happened? Deaths have gone down. And do you know why deaths have gone down? Because instead of taking a dog that just has a broken leg and killing it, and euthanizing it, because it's more expensive to fix the dog's broken leg than it is to euthanize it, they start fixing the dog's broken leg. Because they don't want you to know that they're euthanizing dogs that just have broken legs.
Lawmakers accepted the amendment. Meanwhile, Shalimar Republican Representative Matt Gaetz also hoped to use Grant's bill. He wanted to create regulations for fantasy sports games while clarifying that the games aren't gambling. But many, like Miami Republican Representative Carlos Trujillo, raised concerns about legitimizing the games, which Trujillo argues are gambling.
This will be the one of the massive expansions of gambling that we've ever seen in our state. And as we go forward, the fight for millennials and people in their 30s and 20s is not about slots. Slots aren't the wave of the future for gambling. It's all internet gambling.
Gates asked that his amendment be temporarily postponed. Grant's measure, with Moskowitz's amendment still attached, is scheduled to come up for a vote in the House Monday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
At the heart of modern political debates is the role and size of government to expand or regulate, support or restrict. And for many, the crux of the issue is how government should handle the disadvantaged. This week, Florida lawmakers considered two sides of the same coin, public assistance. Kate Payne has that story.
Public safety nets or entitlement programs are either the saving grace of a progressive society or a cancer on American free market morality. Depends on who you ask. This week, lawmakers considered both. Thursday, the Senate took up a bill aimed at slowing the cycle of homelessness in Florida. The Sunshine State was ground zero for the housing market collapse, and Republican Senator David Simmons of Longwood says we're still recovering.
As you know, homelessness rates in Florida have risen, and the state now ranks third in the number of people affected.
Now Simmons is offering a plan that could free up more state funds for rent assistance. Simmons' bill would give local governments more leeway when using state housing initiative partnership or SHIP funds.
This has a dramatic impact. The real strength of the language is the portion that gives the local governments the ability to use a portion of their SHIP funds in order to do rent subsidies and prevent evictions.
Simmons says the way to slow the cycle of homelessness and poverty is to simply get people in housing.
The key element of rapid rehousing is the Housing First philosophy, which offers housing without preconditions, such as employment, income, lack of a criminal background, or sobriety. If issues such as these need to be addressed, the household can address them most effectively once they are in housing.
The Senate passed the bill Thursday. The measure is still awaiting a full vote in the House. Meanwhile, Republican Representative Matt Gaetz of Shalimar wants to change the way the state allocates benefits for the families of undocumented immigrants. While eligible family members can receive assistance, undocumented immigrants cannot. Still, a portion of their wages is factored into the household's total income to calculate their need. Gaetz says these families can effectively get more assistance.
So you could have a circumstance where two houses right next door to each other with the exact same income, but the household that did not have an illegal alien would be ineligible for that temporary cash assistance, and the household with an illegal alien would be eligible, and this cures that inequity.
Under Gaetz's bill, the entire income of undocumented people would be tallied into their family's overall total. The increase could render some families ineligible for assistance entirely. And Gaetz says that's kind of the point.
One of the reasons for the bill is to disincentivize illegal immigration that exists for the purpose of access to state benefits. That would be, I think, the organizing principle of the bill, is to not establish a circumstance where illegal immigration leads to the drawdown of tax dollars from hardworking Floridians.
But opponents say the new calculus could have some unintended consequences. Here's Representative Jose Javier Rodriguez of Miami.
From a policy standpoint, the policy outcome is something that I think nobody here would support, which is the following. It's either a disincentive, it's either an incentive to work less, it's an incentive to not work at all, or worse, it's an incentive to move out of the household so that that person who is a breadwinner, potentially the father, in this example, is no longer a part of the household. Why on earth, for policy reasons, would we want to do this?
The House passed the bill along party lines, and the Senate is expected to take it up on Monday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Over the years, treatments for depression have ranged from lobotomy to electroshock and all manner of psychotropic drugs. But as Carol Gentry from member station WUSF in Tampa reports, some depression patients in that city are undergoing a new kind of treatment that uses no drugs at all.
It's been nearly 6 weeks since a retiree named Linda started getting treatment with psychiatrist Glenn Currier. A tall, slender, white-haired woman in a running suit, Linda enters the room and settles into what looks like a dental chair. A technician readies her for another treatment.
I'll give you your blanket.
Okay.
Come in.
Hi.
Thank you, Dr. Currier.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, Doctor.
Good to see you.
I'm doing good today.
Good.
Really, really good today.
Are
you? Yes.
Yeah. Are you finding these are useful?
Linda, whose last name we're not using to protect her privacy, has suffered from a crippling depression most of her life. She's traveled from her Key Largo home to the University of South Florida in Tampa for a little-known treatment called TMS. Technician Terry Taylor adjusts a curved plastic device so that it covers part of Linda's forehead. Then Taylor sets a digital dial to activate the magnetic coil inside the device. It emits a 4-second burst of electrical current into the brain to stimulate neurons that play a key role in mood disorders. It sounds like a frenzied woodpecker.
How did that feel? That's fine? Okay, good. Well, can you with that delivery?
The machine, called NeuroStar, sounds scary, but Linda says the taps on her forehead aren't painful. As she sits through the half-hour treatment, Linda describes many fruitless efforts to treat her depression. She has tried 26 different medications, none of which worked. Then she discovered transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS for short.
No, I never had any doubts about this.
TMS was first approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration 8 years ago, but it didn't grow very fast. Startup costs were high, and patients had to pay thousands of dollars out of pocket. Now Florida Blue, Medicare, and some other large insurers are covering it for patients who don't respond to antidepressants. Dr. Currier says that's a lot of people.
Medications only work a little more than half the time. I mean, that's the dirty little secret of the field.
Linda says she spent a year trying to get the treatment in Miami. She and her husband decided to move temporarily to Tampa when a spot opened at USF. She says none of the 8 psychiatrists she's seen in the past few years mentioned TMS.
And I'm quite angry about that. I think the psychiatrists out there should tell us depressed people that are suffering.
Currier says before TMS, severely depressed patients had only one alternative, electroconvulsive therapy. It's better known as shock therapy. Currier says ECT has a success rate of 80 to 90%, about 10 percentage points above that of TMS. But patients have to get ECT in a hospital under anesthesia.
It's quick, but it causes a whole seizure and it has side effects associated with it, including often memory loss. So it's a big thing to do, and people don't do it unless they really need to.
Currier says ECT is right for those who can't wait through 6 weeks of TMS.
TMS is much easier. You're awake through it. It doesn't hurt. People are watching Disney movies as they get these treatments.
Research so far shows about two-thirds of TMS patients see a significant benefit, and around half go into remission for at least a year. But it will take more research to tell how long the benefits last for patients like Linda. Currier said some will need booster treatments.
I mean, there is help to be had, and there's no shame in getting it. Nobody needs to walk this earth feeling that way, you know?
As insurers relent on coverage of TMS, the number of community psychiatrists who offer it is growing, making it easier for those who want to try it to find it. For Health News Florida, I'm Carol Gentry in Tampa.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, former and current members of the Florida Supreme Court gathered together this week to remember Leander Shaw, the High Court's first black Chief Justice. And we get that story from Sasha Cordner.
Current Florida Supreme Court Chief Justice Jorge Labarga is the first Hispanic to lead the state's high court. He recently was chosen to serve a second term, which is rare. Labarga opened Wednesday's ceremonial session by talking about Florida's first black chief justice and how hard it was for a prospective black lawyer to take the bar exam at the former DuPont Plaza Hotel in Miami during times of segregation.
His mere presence caused a commotion. People stared. And examination proctors immediately talked to hotel management. Their ultimate solution was that Justice Shaw could not take the bar examination with the white bar applicants. So they moved him off to a separate room. To add insult to injury, Justice Shaw was not permitted to eat at the hotel's restaurant, nor could he stay in the hotel's rooms overnight. He had to sleep elsewhere.
But Labarga says it was Justice Leander Shaw who had the last laugh.
The great irony here, of course, is that only 30 years later, Leander Shaw would ascend to the seat of Florida's Chief Justice, the head of the entire state judicial branch, and also the agency that administers the bar examination.
Former Florida Supreme Court Justice Major B. Harding calls Shaw not just a colleague but a close friend with an infectious smile and a great sense of humor. Harding says Shaw is also remembered by colleagues for his doodling.
Lee was a persistent doodler. When I sat next to Lee, either in conference or on the bench, I got to see some of his doodles firsthand. And even though there may have been some question about whether they constituted art, some of them were framed. But I will remember that the conversation about whether they should be hung in the rotunda of the court died quickly.
Former Justice Joe Hatchett knew Shaw when they were just two of 25 black lawyers in all of Florida. He called him a civil rights pioneer even before the movement. Hatchett says Shaw also quickly became a trusted friend who carried himself well as a justice.
Chief Justice Shaw had all the qualities of a great justice. He had temperament to listen and consider what was argued on all sides. He had intelligence to quickly perceive, comprehend, analyze, and understand complex fact situations and circumstances. He had courage, the willingness to do what the law required, even when it was not the popular course. And he had integrity.
And current Justice Barbara Pariente says she agrees. She served on the High Court with Shaw during his last 5 years and her first five. Pariente says even when Shaw knew he'd be challenged for his judicial opinion, he still did what he thought was right.
His 1990 attack came as a result of an opinion that he authored involving basic rights and liberties of women. And he knew that that opinion was going to be controversial. But not only did he write it, but he signed his name to it. And sure enough, he received a merit retention challenge. And that really does exemplify not only his understanding of the role of the judiciary, but his courage.
The ceremonial session, which lasted about an hour, included several other tributes to Shaw, from readings of his opinions to the recital of a poem written by his mother, initially read at Shaw's retirement ceremony in 2002. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Eben, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us again each weeknight during the 2016 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.